This is Bradcast producer Desi Doyen. We're off this week, so please enjoy this encore Bradcast, originally recorded on May 9th, 2024.
We all know, intuitively, that a lot of illegals are voting in federal elections, but
really?
It's not been something that is easily provable. We don't have that number.
Ah, I wonder why we don't have that number. I wonder why it's not been proven for some reason.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
I think we know why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
You know what,
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle, Washington on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. We have got a lot to cover, all sort of all over the place today.
Which is kind of how it works these days.
Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi.
Yes, as everything happens everywhere all at once.
Yeah.
But let me start here. John Harwood is a veteran American journalist. He is no liberal lefty. He writes about the ongoing tiff between the New York Times and the Biden White House in his latest newsletter. This tiff, which has the White House, it's about the White House not yet granting the so-called paper of record a one-on-one interview so far this campaign season with the president, due in no small part, apparently, to the White House's displeasure with the way in which the Times has been covering the race by underreporting on Trump's infirmities as a candidate, just to put it nicely, it's early in the show, and overplaying Joe Biden's infirmities, at least as the White House seems to see it. Writing in his newsletter, The Stakes with John Harwood, the veteran reporter, who has recently enjoyed a one-on-one interview with Biden himself, offers some important perspective for journalists, and I would argue for listeners and every American alike. In his piece headlined, "As a veteran reporter, I've always valued neutrality, but Trump's threat to democracy should be the biggest political story of 2024. It's a lot in that headline, but I think you get the point. He writes, "For as long as I've been a reporter, maintaining neutrality while covering politicians has been journalists' mandate. But 2024 presents a different issue. Should reporters also be neutral about the fate of American democracy?" That question lies behind the tension between the Biden White House and the New York Times that recently burst into public view, and it challenges the relevance of conventional journalistic objectivity to the choice voters face in 6 months. Reporters should not take sides, he writes, between incumbent and challenger, but defining the practical contours of that stance in a contest between the current president and his predecessor is a more complicated line-drawing exercise. Harwood says Donald Trump is the first American presidential candidate to explicitly threaten the democratic system on which a free press depends. He could win, considering the stakes for the country, that ought to be the campaign issue that dwarfs all others. He says Times executive director Joseph Kahn doesn't think so. Citing opinion polls, he told Semaphore recently that voters care less about preserving democracy than they do about immigration and inflation and the economy. Rather than becoming a so-called propaganda arm of the Biden campaign, Kahn shapes coverage by voters' concerns, he says. Harwood notes his argument presents a couple of problems. First, allocating journalistic resources by polling cedes the judgment of editors to political actors who work overtime to shape public opinion. That's particularly problematic as authoritarian foreign powers such as Russia, amplified by some members of the Republican Party, relentlessly inject propaganda into our public debates. And of course, that is going to affect public opinion. That's going to affect the things they care about. And if we only cover the things they care about, not the things that we know to be important, well, then we end up where we are right now. Second, notes Harwood, the imperative not to aid the pro-democracy side becomes a little precious when the alternative poses a clear and present danger to the constitutional order. Journalists are not indifferent to the survival of the American system, writes Harwood. Neutrality between political actors has been a cardinal journalistic principle since 20th century news organizations adopted a professional ethic of objectivity. The power of that principle explains why so many journalistic accounts frame Biden and Trump in parallel as two sides of the conventional political coin. So instead of analyzing the two men's demonstrated capacities to handle the presidency, for example, stories observe that Trump holds an edge because voters consider Biden too old. But poll-driven balance represents a dubious safe harbor when the central issue is preserving or abandoning free and fair elections, popular sovereignty, and the rule of law. Consequences that momentous demand sustained, sober exploration. There's no doubt that Trump, not Biden, places those core American values in jeopardy. The January 6, 2021 insurrection wrote Trump's intentions in blood. He promised more depredations in a second term. Trump's authoritarian platform calls for turning the federal bureaucracy into his personal instrument. He vows to make the Justice Department a weapon of, quote, retribution against his enemies, and raises the specter of violence, quote, if we don't win. The Times and other publications have covered those plans extensively, notes Harwood. The stories make clear the authors disapprove of them. If journalists favor democracy over autocracy, and they do, that's only natural. How explicitly and how often journalists should convey that judgment, well, that poses a harder question, he notes. The Times says it can favor the cause of democracy without favoring Biden. But that line of demarcation appeals to all conventional journalists, including me, but in a binary choice election, it may be a distinction without a difference. Covering the menace Trump poses in the proportion it deserves might not influence voters' choices in any case, but it has its own value in affirming another cardinal principle: that journalists center our coverage on what is important and true. Important and true. Never mind the polling. But what is important and true? We will continue to cover what is important and true here on the broadcast, including, by the way, in our latest Green News Report with Desi Doyen coming up later this hour.
Yes, it is.
Even if it requires that we are appearing to take sides, in this case with Joe Biden and the Democrats. And as I've discussed many times over the past year or so, yeah, we are taking sides. Not because I'm a member of the Democratic Party, I am not, or a partisan capital D Democrat, I am not that either. But because I am a small D Democrat, one who believes in democracy over autocracy and sees for the first time, certainly in my lifetime, an incredibly direct threat to that small d American democracy. And yes, the constitutional order. And yes, the rule of law itself, like we have never before seen in this country, certainly not since the Civil War in any event. I struggle with the need to remain objective and accurate every day, especially on days in which I am forced by my own set of ethics and values, yes, as a journalist, to, yes, take sides. I've long said, since the Republican propaganda outlet known as Fox News first began its mission to break America by falsely declaring themselves to be fair and balanced, I've often said that fairness, yes, that's one thing. But balance is often BS, meant to level an unlevel playing field for bad guys. I will do everything that I can to avoid falling into that trap set by Richard Nixon's communications director, Roger Ailes, when he unleashed Fox News to break the nation almost 30 years ago. Because it's a trap that too many journalists, yes, including the editors at the New York Times, have fallen into ever since. As Harwood writes, Donald Trump is the first American presidential candidate to explicitly threaten the democratic system on which a free press depends. He could win. Considering the stakes for this country, that ought to be the campaign issue that dwarfs all others. And so it is. At least on this program, where I get to call the shots as opposed to, well, the polls, the New York Times editors,
true,
Fox News, no matter which political candidates that may favor or disfavor, it doesn't matter. We need to report on what is important and what is true, especially now. My objectivity demands that I tell that truth. I believe the U.S. Constitution demands it as well, which, at least for now, allows me the privilege of belonging to the only industry explicitly cited in the Constitution and given dispensation by it. Yes, that would be a free press. So I believe I owe that to you, my listeners, along with an explanation as to why. So now you know. Again. In any event, more on the direct threat to democracy and elections themselves a little bit later this hour as well. And to the attempt to protect American democracy and the constitutional order and the rule of law in our American judicial system, which is also facing an unprecedented assault by the same former and perhaps future president. So from that high-minded statement to the lowbrow and tawdry affair now playing out over the past couple of days in a criminal courtroom in New York City, which, though seedy and, to say the least, often uncomfortable.
Definitely.
It is also about protecting the integrity of elections and the rule of law. Adult film star Stormy Daniels completed her testimony on Thursday in Manhattan following more than 6 hours on the stand on Tuesday and on Thursday in the first ever criminal trial of a former U.S. president, where Donald Trump is facing charges on 34 state felony crimes related to the reimbursement of a hush money payment to Daniels in the weeks before the 2016 election in hopes of preventing the story of her sexual tryst with Trump from hurting his chances at winning the presidency that year. Yes, in his attempt to try to cheat to win the 2016 election, a cheat that worked. Prosecutors argue Trump's falsification of business records, including checks sent to his attorney, Michael Cohen, to reimburse him for the hush money payment during that first year that Trump served in the White House, was all meant to cover up that payoff in violation of state and federal campaign finance and tax laws. Well, on Thursday, Daniels faced an aggressive cross-examination by Trump's defense attorneys, where she was, oddly and aggressively, pressed as a money-hungry liar, even though, even if true, that would have actually nothing to do with this case. As our friend and frequent guest on the Trump trials, attorney Keith Barber, noted in his coverage on Thursday at Daily Kos following the completion of Daniels' testimony, to understand Trump's defense counsel failure, he writes, let me discuss how they should have treated her testimony before this jury. In a word, they should have treated her testimony as irrelevant, he writes. Trump is not charged with having sex with her or anything to do with the sex with her. Instead of acting like nothing she said mattered to the case, Trump's attorneys treated her as if this were a rape case and the central question was whether they had sex. Instead of minimizing that question, they amplified it to supernova proportions, writes Barber. They actually kept her on the stand for cross-examination longer than the prosecution did for direct, which was just stupid, he says. In attempting to nitpick at supposed inconsistencies, of which they did not really find any in the sordid details of her story, they invited her to go over those sordid details. The defense came across as clumsy, blunt, and bullying in trying to get her to directly admit that she lied. Which, you know, unless you're on in a TV courtroom drama, very few witnesses actually do. Okay, yes, you caught me, and they break down.
True.
Daniels, he says, came across as honest and clever in her responses that insisted she was the honest one and Trump the liar. The entire defense strategy was grossly misplaced, he says, and clearly directed by Trump himself. He wanted them to attack her as a blackmailing extortionist liar, and so they did. In this, Trump's counsel followed their client's wishes rather than sound trial practice. So sad. He says the cross of Daniels was 30 minutes longer than her direct examination. Further, it did more harm than good. At some point, defense counsel's best course is to cut your losses, get a bad witness off the stand, out of the room, and hopefully out of the jury's mind. Trump's counsel went way past that point and served his defense poorly. So there's your Stormy Daniels trial, your 2016 election interference trial update for the day. That case will continue.
Yeah, there's some pretty fun stuff that happened in that trial today.
And a few other news headlines of note today over the past 24 hours or so since we last spoke to you. Desi, as soon as we got off the air yesterday, I looked down at my iPhone and I saw that they were breaking news headlines all over the place coming in that the Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene was demanding another vote to vacate the chair in the U.S. House, like they did with Kevin McCarthy.
Yes.
A vote to oust, in this case, Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson, as she had been threatening for weeks, due apparently in most part to Johnson allowing a vote for aid to Ukraine that was passed with the help of Democrats, even as Donald Trump has been allying with Russian dictator Vladimir Putin to try to block further military aid to our war-torn allies in Ukraine, who are fighting off the brutal, unlawful imperialist invasion by their Russian neighbors. And so anyway, when I saw those headlines right after the show, I thought, oh, shoot, I wish I had noticed them coming in at the end of the day so I could have at least let listeners know about it. But I'm glad I didn't.
I know.
Because about 15 minutes later, it was all over. That's how long it took for Republicans and Democrats in the House, Republicans and Democrats alike, to vote down Marjorie Taylor Greene's stupid resolution. House Speaker Mike Johnson and his allies beat back a dramatic effort by far right Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene to oust him from power on Wednesday, ending for now months of threats against his speakership, according to NBC News. The vote to table, or in effect kill, Green's motion to vacate the speaker's chair was not even close. 359 to 43. Just 10 Republicans. That's all she got. 10 Republicans voted with Green. Now, in normal circumstances, with a one-vote House majority for Republicans and Democrats traditionally voting against the Republican House Speaker, Johnson would have been ousted. But in this case, there were 196 Republicans and 163 Democrats who voted to kill Green's motion, which, by the way, was loudly booed on the House floor when she introduced it.
Sounds like people are getting a little sick of her antics.
Johnson said just off the House floor after the vote, quote, "I appreciate the show of confidence from my colleagues to defeat this misguided effort. Hopefully this is the end of the personality politics and the frivolous character assassination that has defined the 118th Congress. It's regrettable," he says. "It's not who we are as Americans, and we are better than this. We need to get beyond it." Yes, we do need to get beyond it, Mr. Speaker. But what the Speaker failed to highlight was that it was his own party which continues these frivolous character assassinations, and it was, in fact, Democrats who came to his aid, to the Republican House Speaker's aid. And by the way, what I believe was a very smart, if unprecedented, move by those Democrats. In her resolution and on the floor, Green quoted Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries of New York, who said in a recent 60 Minutes interview, quote, "Even though we're in the minority, we effectively have been governing as if we're in the majority because we continue to provide a majority of the votes necessary to get things done. Those are just the facts," said Jeffries. And in fact, those are just the facts. And when Marjorie Taylor Greene actually read that quote, Democrats cheered as she quoted their leader. After the vote, Jeffries spoke to reporters.
"Our decision to stop Marjorie Taylor Greene from plunging the House of Representatives and the country into further chaos is rooted in our commitment to solve problems for everyday Americans in a bipartisan manner. We need more common sense and less chaos in Washington, D.C. Marjorie Taylor Greene and extreme MAGA Republicans are chaos agents. House Democrats are change agents. We will continue to govern in a reasonable, responsible, and results-oriented fashion and put people over politics all day and every day."
Well done. I think that Democrats are going to get a lot of credit for helping to avoid another three-week or longer shutdown of the U.S. House. That's what occurred the last time that Republicans ousted their own speaker, Kevin McCarthy, earlier this year. Then could not agree on a replacement for weeks as the business of the nation languished. They can't do anything in the House without a speaker. And not only is it smart because of that, but I think it's double smart because it's going to infuriate the far right Republicans against their own party for once again working with Democrats, you know, for the good of the nation. So Jeffries is very smart. And even though the whole incident took, about less than 30 minutes to ultimately play out, I think that it's going to be good for Democrats at the polls this November, which in turn, as I mentioned earlier, will be good for the nation and democracy. In other news of note over the past 24 hours that I believe will ultimately, at least I hope, ultimately serve the cause of democracy as well. We told you earlier in the week about the scoop from Axios last week that the U.S. had blocked a shipment of U.S.-made offensive arms to Israel. That scoop last week was based on several Israeli sources at the time who spoke exclusively to Axios. But over the past day or two, U.S. government sources have now, yes, confirmed that they did indeed block the shipment of a whole bunch of huge offensive, 2,000-pound bombs that were earmarked for Israel, thanks to Israel's failure to guarantee the safety of hundreds of thousands of civilian refugees in Rafah in southern Gaza. In a promised ground assault by Israel of the war-torn enclave in that war following the Hamas attack last year that caused the death of more than 1,000 Israelis, President Biden had sought such assurances for months from Israel, but apparently has now drawn a line in the sand when it comes to an attack on Rafah in southern Gaza without any plan, apparently, for the safety and security of civilians in a war that has reportedly resulted in the deaths of more than 30,000, mostly women and children, in Palestine. A war that, in addition to causing an unspeakable human rights disaster, has also sparked protests at college campuses across this country in recent days. In an interview late on Wednesday, President Biden, a longtime supporter of Israel, said that he would not supply offensive weapons that Israel could use to launch an all-out assault on Rafah, the last major Hamas stronghold in Gaza, over concern for the well-being of the more than 1 million civilians who are sheltering there. He said he would still apparently continue to supply defensive weapons for Iron Dome, etc., but not offensive weapons, at least in this case. Biden, in the interview with CNN's Aaron Burnett, said the U.S. was still committed to Israel's defense for Iron Dome rocket interceptors and other defensive arms, but that if Israel goes into Rafah, quote, we're not going to supply the weapons and artillery shells that have been used.
Civilians have been killed in Gaza as a consequence of those bombs and other ways in which they go after population centers. I made it clear that if they go into Rafah, they haven't gone into Rafah yet. If they go into Rafah, I'm not supplying the weapons that have been used historically to deal with Rafah, to deal with the cities, to deal with that problem. We're going to continue to make sure Israel is secure in terms of Iron Dome and their ability to respond to attacks like came out of the Middle East recently. But it's just wrong. We're not going to supply the weapons and the artillery shells used that have been used.
Artillery shells as well.
Yeah, artillery shells.
So, just to understand what they're doing right now in Rafah, is that not going into Rafah as you defined?
No, they haven't gone into the population centers. What they did is right on the border, and it's causing problems with right now in terms of with Egypt, which I've worked very hard to make sure we have a relationship and help. But I've made it clear to Bibi in the War Cabinet, they're not going to get our support if, in fact, they go in these population centers.
President Biden on CNN on Wednesday. The interview marked his toughest public comments yet about the potential Israeli military operation and followed his decision to pause a shipment of heavy bombs to Israel last week over concerns that the U.S. ally was moving closer to an attack on Rafah, despite public and private warnings from his administration. In response, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made clear that he will go it alone if necessary, with or without American support, in a war that the far-right prime minister needs to keep going as long as possible because he's so wildly unpopular in Israel, he will almost certainly be forced out of office as soon as the fighting concludes, if it ever does, and he will then face long-standing felony charges and now perhaps even war crimes charges that could be brought following his months of war on Gaza. Whether any of that, Biden's red line drawn at supplying offensive weapons to Israel for now, will make any difference in this November's elections to the many young, otherwise Democratic-leaning voters who have been protesting against the Biden administration's support for Israel's war in recent weeks at college campuses, well, that remains to be seen. And as to the election itself and the many threats to it, let's take a quick break here. We will come back with just a few of the many that have come to light in recent days and continue to do so. I'm Brad Friedman, and you're listening to The Bradcast, Smartly Done.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast. Welcome back. Bradcast, Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. There have been just a flood of stories like this one coming out in recent days about the tangible threat to this year's elections from, frankly, both inside and outside the U.S. This one from USA Today on Wednesday. The Department of Homeland Security is preparing for a potentially unprecedented array of election threats. Oh, goody.
Yay.
Including meddling by foreign governments, bomb threats, intimidation at the polls, and the intentional spreading of disinformation to confuse voters. That, according to DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas in an exclusive interview with USA Today. Quote, We are dealing with it with intensity, he said. The right to vote and the integrity of the right to vote and therefore of the election itself is a fundamental element of our democracy. DHS, especially through its Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, is mobilizing more than ever to help state and local officials bolster election infrastructure against threats, according to Mayorkas. In January of 2017, in response to Russia's aggressive effort to meddle in the 2016 presidential election and to hack the Democratic National Committee servers, DHS at that time designated the election process as part of the nation's critical infrastructure, which means protecting election-related assets, systems, and networks, whether physical or virtual, as a top priority because they are considered, quote, so vital to the United States that their incapacitation or destruction would have a debilitating effect. So protecting elections and its infrastructure the way we, you know, protect nuclear missile silos and, you know, energy plants and so forth. According to Mayorkas, Homeland Security is monitoring three main types of threats. One is the cybersecurity threat to the integrity of U.S. elections, quote, very often by adverse nation states, he says. U.S. intelligence officials have concluded that Russia, China, Iran, and perhaps other nations have continued to meddle in the U.S. electoral process. Another, Mayorkas said, is the physical threat to local election officials and poll workers that has already spiked since the 2020 election and Trump's false claims about voter fraud. Examples of that abound. The paper cites one Texas man who threatened an Arizona County election official and the official's children back in 2022, warning of a, quote, mass shooting of poll workers. Another down in Florida threatened election workers by asking at a polling site, quote, should I kill them one by one or should I blow the place up? Yeah, democracy is under assault, isn't it? Democrats also fear violence from those who would reject election results showing Joe Biden being reelected. The third risk, Mayorkas said, is the, quote, threat of disinformation, including the intentional spreading of false information to deceive people into thinking that their vote need not be, for example, placed on Tuesday, when in fact it needs to be placed by Tuesday. So expect much more of this sort of thing, unfortunately. They cite the robocall this year in January to many Democratic voters in New Hampshire with an artificial intelligence generated fake voice that was sounded like Joe Biden's voice trying to dissuade them from voting in the state's primary election. Going to see a lot more of this between now and November and after Election Day as well, at least in the event that Donald Trump loses. And while much of the concern, of course, is what will happen if Trump wins this November. And both he and his party have made clear the type of authoritarian assault on our constitutional order that we will face in that event. Don't sleep on what is likely to happen if Trump does not win. They have been perfecting their methods of stealing an election since 2020 when they tried to do so in multiple ways, but they failed. The threat is superheated, extremely complex, extremely volatile, and there's a variety of threat actors and a variety of methods that they may use to disrupt elections, according to Elizabeth Newman, who was Assistant Secretary of Counterterrorism and Threat Prevention at DHS during the Trump administration. She says it's very difficult to protect against because we don't know where it will manifest, when it will manifest, or how it will manifest. She said, we're on a tinderbox, and DHS has a fundamental and very important role in helping secure our election. I have just seen a ton of stories, similar stories, about like this, about the threats to elections and the efforts to help election officials protect themselves from threats and to protect the election itself. And threats against a number of election officials, which has led them to quit their jobs as officials at historic high rates ahead of the 2024 election. And I suspect we will be digging into all of that as the months wear on and November 5th nears. But today I just want to focus on, some of the easier threats in one sense, the ones that we know are happening, and they're happening right now.
They're doing it right out front.
In broad daylight.
Yeah.
And it's high-ranking Republican officials who are doing it. Officials who are spreading out and out disinformation right now, already on a regular basis. And they're not receiving the pushback or the fact-checking that I think they deserve, given how easy it is to spread disinformation and how difficult it is to counter that bad information. GOP is now all in on election interference and election denial, denying results that they don't like, even if there is no actual, evidence to back up their claims of fraud. When Trump officially took over the RNC some weeks ago, ousting longtime chair Ronna Romney McDaniel and replacing her with an election denier from North Carolina, a guy by the name of Michael Whatley, as chair, and his own daughter-in-law, Laura Trump, as co-chair. When they did that, they reportedly fired the entire RNC staff. They forced them all to reapply for their jobs, and they asked them, as part of the rehiring process, about whether they believed if the 2020 election was stolen or not, even though there is zero evidence that it was stolen. But hey, if you want that job... Trump has made very clear that to be considered for his for the vice presidential nomination, that election denialism is also a mandatory thing for any potential candidate. That played out this past week on Meet the Press on NBC last Sunday when South Carolina's U.S. Senator Tim Scott debased and disgraced himself in hopes of winning the nod as Trump's veep.
Senator, will you commit to accepting the election results of 2024, bottom line?
Well, at the end of the day, the 47th president of the United States will be President Donald Trump, and I'm excited to give back to low inflation, low unemployment.
Wait, Senator, yes or no, will you accept the election results of 2024 no matter who wins?
That is my statement.
But is it just yes or no? Will you accept the election results of 2024?
I look forward to President Trump being the 47th president. Kristen, you can ask him multiple times.
Senator, just a yes or no answer.
So the American people will make the decision.
But I don't hear you committing
for President Trump. That's that clear.
I don't hear you committing to the election results.
Here's the challenge.
Will you commit to accepting the election results?
This is why so many Americans believe that NBC is an extension of the Democrat Party. At the end of the day, I've said what I've said. And I know that the American people, their voices will be heard. And I believe that President Trump will be our next president. It's that simple.
Yeah, and it went on for much longer than that.
Oh,
and
yes.
You rarely hear me say it, but good for Kristen Welker for pressing him on that. Now, in one sense, it's actually kind of an unfair question to ask someone if they will accept results before they've even seen the results. But you know, Tim Scott could have said, of course, once we see the results, once we assure that they have been fair and counted accurately and we've exercised any of our due legal process to ensure as much, once the results have been verified and certified as accurate, of course, we will accept them and support the peaceful transfer of power, or something like that. Instead, he just obviously refused to answer the question at all because he knows that election denialism, full tilt, is the top requisite for being named as Trump's VP. If you're not willing to do that, he won't even be considering you. And remember, that's a guy, Tim Scott, who voted to confirm the 2020 election as a U.S. senator on January 6th. Now, well, we'll see. Now that he's angling for this new job where lying about elections is the number one requirement. Back at the RNC, when Trump took over the party outright a few weeks ago, they named two attorneys to head up their so-called election integrity unit. One was a woman named Christina Bobb, a former reporter for the far-right One America News Network. She has since been indicted on felony conspiracy charges in Arizona for her alleged role in the fake electors plot in that state. She has not, however, stepped down from her role as head of the party's election integrity unit, even as she faces election fraud charges. And the other was a guy named Charlie Spies. Last weekend, Spies was pushed out of his job heading up the RNC's election integrity unit because apparently they found out he's not an election denier. He was hired in March to lead the committee's legal efforts amid the RNC overhaul. Spies was previously described by a campaign official as, quote, the best at what he does. He knows the FEC loopholes better than anyone. He is a longtime Republican lawyer, best known for expanding the use of super PACs after the landmark Citizens United decision. But even he had to go. Apparently, he previously worked for Florida Governor Ron DeSantis during the GOP primary. He was also behind a super PAC that Jeb Bush used during the 2016 cycle. He served in Mitt Romney's 2008 presidential campaign. But word got out that he didn't think the election was stolen from Donald Trump in 2020. And that was it for Spies.
So he had to be purged.
He did. Donald Trump took to his social media platform on Sunday after news broke and said, quote, great news for the Republican Party. Rhino lawyer Charlie Spies is out as chief counsel of the RNC. I wish him well. He wishes him well. He just hired him a month earlier, and now he's out because he's a rhino, because he refuses to be an election denier. In a statement responding about Spies being pushed out of the RNC, a DNC spokesperson said that Trump's takeover of the RNC has led to, quote, an election denier litmus test for new hires. So this is the whole game. At this point, lying about elections and institutionalizing voter suppression in the bargain. The RNC itself is now leading the disinformation effort on that front. Here was brand new RNC co-chair Laura Trump. I bet she won't be fired. Laura Trump on Fox News with once legitimate business reporter, now insane MAGA Trumper, Maria Bartiromo, late last week.
Saying for a while now that your priority is to ensure a transparent election. And I see that the RNC and the Trump campaign filing a lawsuit in a battleground state to stop counting ballots past Election Day. What are you doing with regard to suing Nevada right now?
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. You cannot have ballots counted, Maria, after elections are over. And right now, that is one of the many lawsuits we have out across this country to ensure that just that happens, that we have a free, fair, and transparent election. So in Nevada, as you pointed out, we are saying we want on Election Day that to be the last day that mail-in ballots can be counted. And we've been very successful in a lot of lawsuits. A couple weeks ago, we won a big lawsuit in the state of Pennsylvania. They wanted to take off dates from mail-in ballots, of course, the Democrats, in an effort to make it easier to cheat. We pushed back on that. We won. And that set precedent for the entire country.
Okay. You cannot count ballots after elections are over, she says. You have to count ballots after elections are over. That's when the ballots are available to be counted. If you can't count past Election Day, what does that mean? That anything at midnight, everybody's got to go home? That's it. Whoever hasn't been counted by now, that's it. You're out of luck.
It's like pencils down at your test. That's it.
Now, I think she's likely talking about the receipt of mail-in ballots that come in after Election Day because more Democrats than Republicans tend to vote by mail. So they want to stop the counting of perfectly valid ballots that were cast before the election was ended, that were postmarked before Election Day, but penalize the voters because the post office doesn't get the ballots to the election headquarters before the close of Election Day, before the close of polls that day. As to the and they're perfectly legitimate ballots. They may have been cast several days before Election Day, but because of, you know, for example, Donald Trump's postmaster general, they just don't get there in time. As to the Pennsylvania case that she mentioned, where she said Democrats wanted to take off dates from absentee ballots to make it easier to cheat. No.
That's a lie.
We covered that as well earlier this week, I think, or last week. It's about a space to write the date on the outside envelope, not on the ballot, on the outside envelope that the envelope that encloses the ballot, the secrecy envelope. And sometimes people forget to write the date in that space, or they write 2023 instead of 2024, et cetera. Republicans want to toss that out, toss out those ballots, even though both Democrats and Republicans admitted in the there's an ongoing court battle about this, admitted that those dates aren't actually used for anything. There are postmarks on the envelope. Those are used if there's any question about when the ballots were sent. Republicans, however, they want to toss out those ballots even if they arrive a week before Election Day. But if someone has put on the wrong date somehow, put on their birth date or forgot to fill it in or put the wrong year in this completely meaningless field on the outer envelope, they want to throw out those ballots because they know more of them are cast by Democrats than Republicans, and they're willing to take their chances. And then on Wednesday, I believe, I don't know if it was before or after Democrats helped him to keep his job in the U.S. House, Republican Speaker Mike Johnson made this announcement during a press conference about a new bill called the Safeguard American Voter Eligibility, or SAVE Act, that Republicans are proposing in the House to make it illegal for undocumented immigrants to vote in federal elections, which is already unlawful by federal law in all 50 states. But, says Mike Johnson,
we all know intuitively that a lot of illegals are voting in federal elections, but it's not been something that is easily provable. We don't have that number. This legislation will allow us to do exactly that. It will prevent that from happening. And if someone tries to do it, it will now be unlawful, and the states will have a mechanism to prove whether they are or not. And to suggest that this is some sort of revenge tour is kind of a silly notion.
Oh, is it, Mike? We know intuitively they're voting. We know it's not provable. We don't have the numbers or the evidence, but intuitively we know it's happening. It must be happening. In other words, there's zero evidence that it is happening, but that's what we're all agreeing to believe on, to believe in on the Republican side, despite any evidence and despite the fact that it is already unlawful for non-citizens to vote in federal elections. Sponsors of this bill include Congressman Chip Roy of Texas, Senator Mike Lee of Utah, both of whom know better, but they don't care. They use the press conference to elevate right-wing talking points about Joe Biden's, quote, reckless open borders and the alleged threat of non-citizens casting ballots that could change the outcome of the elections, even though experts agree that is not actually a thing. But yes, it's a thing on the right. They believe that these people are coming in from other countries and they're being handed a ballot the minute they walk in the door.
To be honest, I don't think any of them actually believe that. Well, maybe some of the crazier ones.
Well,
but
the people who listen to them do.
Right.
Chip Roy doesn't. Mike Lee knows it doesn't happen. Mike Johnson knows it doesn't. I think Mike Johnson knows it doesn't happen.
I'm
not
sure
how smart he is. But so this has been going on for a long time. This has been a claim that is false over and over again. As Justin Levitt of Loyola Law School is an occasional guest on this program over the years, as he said, the biggest single reason not to vote when you're a non-citizen is that not only is there a serious criminal penalty attached and a serious fine attached, you can be removed from the country. So why would they do it? They wouldn't. I would also add, by the way, that people who are here unlawfully do not want to commit a crime that will bring attention to them. And if you register to vote, you have to give your name and your ID and the address where you live. And it's very easy to check those names because voter registration rolls are public records. You could look it up and find if people are citizens or not. You are begging to be deported if you do something like that. It's stupid. Nobody does it, at least not on purpose. There is no evidence of it. And of course, Mike Johnson knows that, despite saying that we all know intuitively that illegals are voting. So, yeah, there are a lot of foreign threats to our elections this year, and they are very real. But the first and loudest threat, I should say, is coming from inside the House, and the Republican Party is leading the way, and you need to know about it. So heads up. Green News Report is next. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is serving you. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you.
You're listening to an encore presentation of The Bradcast.
Okay, too much news, too little time. As usual, let's get straight to it. Our latest Green News Report.
A tornado went through, and then about 45 minutes later, another tornado almost on the direct same path.
Tornado outbreaks leave trail of destruction across multiple states. Republicans ban climate change in Florida just in time for hurricane season. Plus,
mankind's melting the polar ice caps, destroying the ecosystem. They got it coming.
A shift is underway in how U.S. culture portrays climate reality.
All of those realities and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
I was proud to lead the House Republican effort to protect our gas stoves.
Thank you for your service and courage, Congresswoman Debbie Lesko. Sorry to see you leaving. Can I help you with the door? This is your Green News Report.
I'm gonna soak up the sun.
Okay, Desi Doyen, while Republicans in Congress are pretending that their gas stoves and appliances are under fire, hundreds of thousands of people right now in southern Brazil are literally underwater thanks to the climate change that these people are ignoring. It is just appalling. What do you have for us today?
Well, here in the U.S., this spring is a doozy for extreme weather, with deadly storms and multiple tornado outbreaks leaving a trail of destruction across the plains and southern states. Over just the last week or so, the U.S. has seen well over 100 tornadoes, an unusually high number. The governors of Michigan and Tennessee declared tornado emergencies on Wednesday. But unfortunately for Oklahoma residents, their Republican governor back in 2022 vetoed bipartisan legislation that would have funded upgrades to the state's rural warning systems. He called it irresponsible spending.
Yes, but I hope he protected our gas stoves.
In fact, the U.S. just saw the second highest number of tornadoes ever recorded in the month of April. More than 300 tornadoes, more than double the average. Climate scientists say the recent surge in tornadoes is primarily goosed by El El Niño. But overall, data is mixed on how man-made climate change influences tornadoes. But studies have found that a warming climate is increasing the conditions for the formation of tornado clusters, extreme storms, and dangerous nighttime tornadoes. In politics, the Republican-controlled U.S. House this week continued their war on woke appliances, passing a bill to make it harder for the Department of Energy to set energy efficiency standards for household appliances that save Americans money and reduce pollution. Here's House Republican Elise Stefanik of New York.
The Hands Off Our Home Appliances Act protects Americans from Joe Biden's failed far-left anti-American energy agenda.
Oh, my God.
The bill won't pass the Senate, but it could next year if Republicans gain full control of Congress in the November elections. In Florida, the Republican legislature passed a law to end the state's support of renewable energy and ban offshore wind farms to keep Florida dependent on fossil fuels. The bill, awaiting Governor Ron DeSantis' signature, would also erase mention of climate change in state laws and policies, despite Florida's extreme vulnerability to heat, storms, and rising sea levels.
Well, everyone knows if you can't say it, it doesn't exist.
In other news, the Federal Energy Information Administration says the U.S. power grid is getting cleaner, but deployment of renewable energy sources is not moving fast enough to meet U.S. climate targets. The agency found increases in U.S. electricity demand are being met almost entirely by cheap renewables. A New York Times analysis shows that the U.S. electric grid is increasingly being stabilized by giant utility-scale batteries that are delivering clean solar power after dark in California and helping to stabilize grids in multiple states.
Nice.
Globally, clean renewable energy continues to surge. According to nonprofit think tank Ember, for the first time ever, renewable energy now produces 30% of the world's electricity supply, and the rate of renewable deployment is itself accelerating. Wind and solar are now the fastest growing sources of new electricity generation in history.
Very nice.
And finally, a culture shift appears to be underway in U.S. entertainment.
Uh-oh.
Mentions of climate change are finally increasing in fictional films and TV, like this from 2017's Justice League.
Mankind's melting the polar ice caps, destroying the ecosystem. They got it coming.
I don't mind if the oceans rise.
How about if they boil?
The Climate Reality Check report by nonprofit group Good Energy found that popular fictional movies in recent years now mention climate change far more than films released in the first half of the 2010s. It's not much, but it is a start. They call on studios, filmmakers, and writers to, quote, provide narratives that speak to our climate reality.
Great, but who will speak up for our gas stoves? For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. Gotta gas our way out of here. Thank you very much, Desi Doyen. Yep. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or any other, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. That made possible by those of you who hit a donate button or go to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. Drop me an email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com, and you'll find me on the social medias at The Brad Blog. We'll see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.